Hello and welcome to Holden Village. Today is June 22nd, 2006. Our session today is entitled, Is It All Because of Sprawl? Our presenter is Kathy Dowd. Session number DOC 2006-4. Let's listen in.
I'm Kathy Dowd. I'm happy to see some of you who always come. I always feel like we're having a good conversation. I called this session, Is It All Because of Sprawl? And I'll explain that. But I want us to first start with defining sprawl, because there are many definitions out there, and I think we all have to have some picture in our mind of what we're talking about before we can sort of go on to the other questions here. So I found two definitions of sprawl, and there's certainly more out there. Here's one. Sprawl is the spreading out of a city and its suburbs over more and more rural land at the periphery of an urban area. This involves the conversion of open space, rural land, into built-up developed land over time. Okay. It also says here, it's possible to have well-planned sprawl or chaotic sprawl, to have high-density or low-density sprawl, to have auto-dependent or mass transit-oriented sprawl. But regardless of the quality of the sprawl, the amount of sprawl is measured by the square miles of rural land eliminated by urban development. Generally, well-planned sprawl will result in fewer square miles of rural land being covered by urban development. Okay, so there's one definition of sprawl, and this would include all types of land uses. It could be business, residential, industrial, all types of land uses that would bring us out from the urban core and spread us outwards. Okay? There's a second definition of sprawl that I want to use, at least in our discussion, because of some of the research that's been done using this definition. And that is, and this one is more simple, a sprawl level is measured as the share of area jobs located outside of a 10-mile ring around the area's central business district. So the share of area jobs located outside a 10-mile ring of the central business district. Now, this definition of sprawl seems to me it is just business-oriented. It's just based on jobs. So in that sense, it sort of lacks that, like, housing developments and those that sort of sprawl that I think probably when you picture it, yeah.
Central business district is a misnomer. In Seattle, the downtown area, in the studies they've done, 15% of the commutes are to downtown.
Okay.
85% are to other places in the surrounding suburban areas. So to say you're going to put all the workers downtown is a mistake.
Okay. Okay. So you think with that definition, then it doesn't really work because that, like, central business area would include that sort of outer areas where people are working?
Well, for Seattle, it's probably a 50-mile circle if you're going to look at where most of the people are working.
Yeah, and so then you would be 10 miles beyond that to start thinking about sprawl. Okay, well, what do you guys picture when you see?
In Seattle, it's really a dozen cities, a dozen urban centers.
Oh, like Bellevue and
Renton. I mean, they're cores, and they all run together. Sometimes the line between them is kind of vague. I guess it's on the map, but
yeah.
You drive it, you wouldn't see it.
You don't recognize that.
Yeah, there's no open space or undeveloped land in between. But they're really like just a whole bunch of cities.
Yeah.
And some people move between cities in their work, but a lot of them work within Bellevue, they work within Renton, they work within the Federal Way area, if you work for an airline or whatever.
Right. So that second definition is probably difficult for us to use. What do you guys?
It's too simplistic.
Yeah. What do you guys think of when you think of sprawl? Like, what are the pictures in your mind?
What I picture is every time I go in to visit my mother-in-law, the housing developments are farther and farther away from Chicago. Mm-hmm. And well, I shouldn't define that as Chicago. I'm from Illinois, Western Illinois. A lot of the communities, people are now commuting from 50, 60, 70, sometimes even 80 miles away from Chicago, and so the smaller communities are starting to spread out into it, and it's. That, to me, is what the sprawl is. It's like putting a thin layer of construction over everything.
Okay. What about the rest of you? What do you see?
Moving out into areas where the infrastructure schools, the churches, whatever.
My definition of sprawl is based on the amount of undeveloped land between developed sections.
Okay.
Kind of a checkerboard sort of thing, where there's a lot of undeveloped land, but there's a lot of development, and there's all these little
blocks. So that leapfrogging.
The leapfrogging thing, mm-hmm. Yeah.
So I was just going to say the same thing. That's what's happening in the Olympia area and probably a lot of other areas. There's sections of development taking place like 5-6 miles out of town at least, and they're there. You've been going along for a long time, and then you've got these huge developments.
Well, Davenport, Iowa, we have lots of land. The center of the city is dying, so we have big vacant buildings, and they keep building out and out right over all the rich farmland.
Yeah, yeah.
We have areas where the development is within a couple hundred feet of the main highways going through, and everything else is just usually abandoned land.
Yeah, big box stores, business parks.
Well, even houses will be strung out along the roadways, along the corridors, everything.
In Minnesota, they're finding that a lot of the development is going along the Minnesota or the Mississippi River, and it's disrupting the flyways and the places that the birds always came in. And I kind of like you growing up on a farm, it's like they're covering up that wonderful farmland. Can't be made again to grow grass.
Okay, so we pretty much have a good picture of it. It's like you could think of it as a thin layer of housing and business parks and the big box stores. I don't think we tend to think of sprawl as industrial, do we?
That's all in China.
A plant builds out in the suburbs, and people live around their home, where they work. So.
We could think of it in those terms because, once again, I'm going back to where the area where I'm living. It wasn't that long ago Pacific put in what they call Global 3, a large container facility. Trains coming in, moving containers home. Move it out. That's by Rochelle, which is, 50, 60 miles west of Chicago? And part of the reason they put it there was nobody in toward the city wanted it. It was not in my backyard, so they put it out in the middle of nowhere. I-88, I-39 cross, this is just west of that, and now they're building a large number of warehousing-type facilities at that intersection. And they're starting to call themselves the hub-type city, where they can take it. Bring stuff in and go in all directions from there, and it has definitely taken up a lot of farmland.
Okay. How many of you think of sprawl as something that is negative? Like when you think of the word, it sounds negative to you. Okay.
Well, I think it's negative because of the reason that why we have it. The reason we have sprawl is because of population growth in this country. I see no reason why this country should grow population. And if we didn't, if we limited our population growth, we would have virtually no sprawl. The reason why people want to build out in the suburbs is because, like we did, we like to raise our kids in the country air. And to force people to live in smaller and smaller lots or build vertically in apartments like us, raising a family, maybe some single people like it or some married couples like it, but most people, and this goes back to the probably to a status of a little bit of wealth, you know. The wealthy people in this country 100 years ago were building houses in the country, big estates like that and so on. People lived in apartments in the towns and the cities, and they didn't want to stay there. They wanted to go out just like the rich do. And now we're getting to the point where we're getting too much of this. There's just too many people. And if we would limit our population growth and maybe someday even reverse it, it solved the problem. But the developers pay the politicians much money for that. So.
I think another factor, though, besides population, is the average square footage of a house. I don't remember the numbers, but it's shot up astronomically.
Double.
Yeah, since like the 50s. So it's like, why do we feel entitled for five people to have a 3,000 square foot house out, you know, way, way, way far away? They can't walk anywhere. I mean, that's a lot different than a 1,500 square foot house, even if it's in a suburb. You know what I'm saying? Yeah. Like, it could still be in a suburb. Doesn't have to be in the city in a high rise, but I mean, just right there, that house is twice as big as the same number of people.
Mm-hmm. Generally, the people I know that live 40, 50, 60 miles out not because they enjoy being in the country. It's the only place they can find an affordable house. Mm-hmm. The ones in the city have a highly inflated price.
And there's more to it than growth in population, because the urban school districts are losing enrollment to the point they're in terrible trouble, because the state gives money according to enrollment. The close-lying unincorporated school districts may be holding their own. The ones farther out are in terrible trouble because their enrollment is booming and they don't have any buildings to put them in. And if the same number of people were redistributed, you would have less problems from sprawl. But the cities become unlivable.
When I think of Rockford, Illinois, the school district is in such a mess and has been for 20 or 30 years. They've been run by the courts and everything else. Nobody wants their kids in the Rockford schools. It's not because of people don't want to live there. There are some very nice areas of Rockford, but only people without children are living there. Mm-hmm. But the school district is so poorly managed and has been for so long. People are living in the collar communities, and it's sprawling out from there.
Mm-hmm. Okay, the when I asked the question, is it all because of sprawl, what I meant by all were some of the sort of environmental and social ills our society faces. And the things I thought of that were related to sprawl are things like pollution, the extension of pollution out from the core of the city, destruction of our natural resources, including farmland and forests. And then I thought of some of the social problems would be inner city blight. The people move from the inner city out further and further and further, and there's nothing left behind in the city but poverty and poor people who can't get out, and also things like problems with schools, if not just bad schools, but sort of uneven schools, where you might have some school districts that have tons of money, good teachers, places where students tend to do better, and then the poor students who are kind of stuck in some of those inner city schools with just other poor kids around them, don't really see any other sort of economic differences between people. So those are the things that I thought were a result of sprawl. I hear some of you agreeing with those things. Are there other things you can think of that are associated with it?
The in our area, the Illinois area, which I think is generally conceded to be some of the best farmland literally in the world,
yeah,
when it's they just, you know, pile it up and build buildings on it. The other
then they
thing
sell it back to you.
Pardon me?
Then they sell it back to you as
then
topsoil.
Then they sell it back to you as topsoil, and usually not as good as topsoil, because that probably went to a golf course someplace.
Yeah.
Well, that's another thing with urban sprawl, is golf courses and a whole, that's a whole other story. But it's the runoff and the fact that the water, one of those papers I was reading, I need to get, I finally finished those things, not from the water you're talking about tomorrow, but because of the water not soaking into the soil and having to do with the global warming, because water vapor being part of that and all that kind of stuff. But just when you have these large parking lots and all this kind of stuff, the stormwater runoff, it's not soaking back down into the ground. It's not getting into the aquifers. It's just being flushed off someplace.
Right, which usually increases the size of floods in areas, because the water gets to the rivers much more quickly rather than soaking in and getting slowly.
Tremendous water problems and temperature problems. Now, I remember when we moved out of Chicago when I was a kid, like 10 years old, into farm community called Naperville, which is a small, it's now the second largest city in Illinois.
Hmm.
But we didn't, you know, all we did put was a fan in the window. It was great because the cities may hold all of this heat. And the sprawl is, I think, probably changing some of the thermal effects in the land, because of all the concrete and that kind of stuff retains heat a lot longer than the ground does.
Right, and then gives it off back at night. And we have seen that we are experiencing warmer nights than we had in the past, and that's what they call a sign of global warming, but it could be a sign of our urban sprawling.
Yeah, in the city, when I was there, we weren't talking global warming. It was in the mid-50s. It was just that the concrete held it,
right,
and when you got out into the country, it didn't. So you don't even have to have global warming for that, to have good heat sinks to then give it back out at night.
Mm-hmm.
I think they use concrete for thermal storage anyway when you're trying to build an efficient house. So.
We live in Southern Puget Sound area, and there at Hurston County, there's been a really major effort to provide stormwater retention to keep it from immediately racing into the bay, into the Sound. And what that's done, it's been effective in doing that. The Sound, at least organically, is cleaner than it's been for 60 years or so. Okay, but it's also increased urban sprawl because now every subdivision's got 10 acres devoted to storm runoff basin. So the density of people per acre is significantly less. That means you've got to get the same number of housing units, you've got to take in more acres. So it's a double-edged sword.
And the other thing that's great about those is you're creating wetlands. Oh, yay!
Yeah.
So we can go out and destroy some natural ones because we've created these man-made ones.
And I'm not saying that's not the right thing to do, but it increases sprawl.
Yeah, and they can actually sell their wetland rights. They can say, well, we're creating a wetland, and another company will pay them to do that so that they can destroy natural wetlands because that's our no net loss policy. One for one, even if that natural wetland has is an incredibly functioning ecosystem, and then this retention pond is a blight.
Mosquito trap.
Yeah, that's another interesting policy.
Or taking land that could be 10 houses.
Yeah,
there is an economic problem going on in parts of the Midwest anyway. The people who are selling their farms in the ring around the city are getting such a large amount of money that they're going out further to buy farmland,
mm-hmm.
which is increasing the price, so the people who are living out there can't afford farmland anymore.
Right.
So it's really causing ripple effects all over the place.
Right, and I've heard talk of changing property tax regulations such that farmers wouldn't pay the same thing that their land would be worth if they sold it to developers, but they would pay a lower tax rate, such as it was when it was just farmland in that area.
They have to reinvest it, otherwise they have to pay capital gains tax, which gets to be quite a bit.
Okay.
If you bought it 40 years ago at $200 an acre, and you get $20,000 an acre,
yeah.
It makes a bit of a difference, too.
Somebody said something about sprawl creates affordable housing, okay? And it's not like you're saying, let's go have sprawl. But there was a study, and this one comes from the Reason Public Policy Institute, which I'll tell you a little bit about them. They're a public policy think tank promoting choice, competition, and a dynamic market economy as the foundation for human dignity and progress. Okay, so I read that. But they're the people who measured sprawl as the share of area jobs located outside of a 10-mile ring around the area's central business district. A study by Matthew Kahn at Tufts University identifies one important benefit of sprawl. It reduces the housing consumption gap between white and black Americans. Sprawling areas tend to have a greater supply of developable land on the urban fringe, which helps to moderate land prices and keep housing affordable. Then inner city housing becomes cheaper as jobs gravitate from cities out to the suburbs. So what they found was that when they're comparing black households, the ones living in the high sprawl area that had bigger houses, that had a bigger income than people who were living in the low sprawl areas.
Mm-hmm.
So they're claiming that minorities will benefit from sprawl. And not just minorities, but really anyone who can't afford housing
$400,000
Yeah, I've never seen any sprawl housing that I thought was affordable. What I considered affordable. When I lived in Rock Island, I had an $80,000 house. It was a great, great place and a great neighborhood. So for me, that's affordable housing. But I didn't ever feel like I could afford the sprawl housing, which started at more than $200,000.
Yeah, when you see
come to California.
Yeah, I know, and I've never lived in
that
place.
And that's the price of a garage in California.
Yeah. I've been spoiled by Rock Island.
I worked for a company that had headquarters in downtown San Francisco for a long time, and the people that worked at corporate simply just kept moving out and out and out until they could afford. That was it.
Mm-hmm.
And if they had to go 90 miles, they either had to go out 90 miles or they had to give up their job and look for something. So it was just all until they could afford.
We did that.
Does anybody not agree that if we could limit our population growth and stabilize population, that this would go a long way to solving this problem, and pollution problems, water shortage problems, energy shortage problems, et cetera, et cetera?
I disagree with you on that.
But the United States is pretty much leveled off. It's partly
it has
all,
not.
We're all coming to the central zones, and we're not spread across. At least the stuff I saw
the population
year.
Is growing this country. We're the fastest growing industrialized country in the world.
But the other ones are negative.
Huh?
Yeah, the other ones are negative.
What's wrong with being negative?
Nothing.
Okay.
Mostly immigrants.
I'm just saying we're not growing.
Immigrants in Washington.
Well, they are. We've got 1% a year.
Can I take Jan since she hasn't had something yet?
Well, what do you want to do? Become China? You know, China has their own problems now as a result of their population policies and their value of male children over female children as the population has gone through a couple decades of that. Now there are not enough women for the men to marry. You know, where does the government come in to legislate your family size? I mean, what is the options for that?
How do you control population? It's fair.
In America, in California, 100% of our population growth is due to immigration and the large families of immigrants. Countrywide, it's about 70%. China got so far. China's about the same land area as we have, but roughly the same size country. And they're 1.3 billion. They face an enormous problem. They did, you know, Mao pushed big families and growth and population for thinking demographics brings power. Well, it does to a certain extent, but it certainly brings overpopulation too. They realize now that they were way overpopulated. I mean, they're more than four times as populated as we are. And we should maybe take a lesson from this and say, it's very difficult to stabilize population. It was very difficult for them. And they had to put this one child in the city, two child in the country rule into play. And now they got a problem with maybe the demographic shifting towards the more aged people and fewer younger people. And as she was saying, too, fewer women being born proportional to the males because they want a male son. But all these things, you know, are brought about by overpopulation, which they didn't recognize soon enough. And this year we're going to hit 300 million in this country, and there's no end in sight to how far we're going to go because nobody wants to talk about it.
Okay, I see a new hand up back there. Did you want to say something?
I don't know. I was just thinking, I don't know, but I think I heard that we're one of the least populated industrial countries, but we consume more resources than any other nation. Mm-hmm. And I think that with the sprawl, all that dawned on me is that perhaps it's a value system problem, okay. That it's indicative of self-indulgence, extravagance, entitlement. Mm-hmm. That is a 500-year history of this country.
Mm-hmm. And is there anything that we can do to change that value system? I mean,
I don't know if we can any more than population growth.
Yeah, I want to put a, I don't know what do you want to call it in the scientific terms, I've forgotten that stuff. I'm wondering if a lot of the sprawl is because of, or certainly energized by our dependence on the automobile. Mm-hmm. We made a conscious decision back in the 20s, 30s, whenever it was, to do away with the interurban system. To go to roads. We do not have efficient public transportation.
Right.
You can't get from A to B. You've got to have a car. Well, that promotes the automobile promotes the sprawl because you've got to have the car to get where you're going anyway, so it doesn't make a difference if you live here, there, or the airplanes. Mm-hmm. If we weren't nearly so dependent on automobiles for transportation anywhere, but had everything along corridors, and I'll use interurbans because they were very efficient back in the teens. I'm not sure we'd have the sprawl that we do now. Mm-hmm. But it's because of our going to a transportation system that promotes spreading out.
Mm-hmm. I don't really think we have to work on changing our value system. I think it's going to be done for us, whether we like it or not, by the energy situation. And I suspect that will govern, that will stop sprawl, it'll actually reverse sprawl. We'll be moving back. back into core areas to reduce transportation expense, to provide for an environment where cogeneration facilities can be operated, which is the biggest untapped energy potential in this country today. And
what do you mean by cogeneration?
Basically, the heat from a thermal power plant is utilized instead of running through a cooling tower. It's widely done in Europe and Scandinavia.
It was done here. All the major cities used to have steam.
In the old days, it was. And then we quit doing it. Okay, but it requires concentrated population. And I think the same thing applies to population growth to a degree. I think the whole unfolding energy situation will cause a decline in population, and I believe it will force us back into core communities. And we won't have any choice about it.
How will this come about? Let's limit immigration. I think saying that most of our growth is immigration related.
Part of the straw problem, though, is from growth in urbanization because people are moving out of the country.
Yeah.
You know, instead of having 70% of our population being farmers raising food like it was in Jefferson's day, it's probably less than, 10%?
Yeah.
And it's maybe, instead of 40 acres and a mule now, it's 1,000 acres or more for a single family farm. And so these people that aren't on the farm got to go somewhere. The only place left is the cities. Hence you get sprawl. Population growth in the cities.
That's part of the problem.
Yeah.
But the other problem is that poor immigrants come in and take the housing in the city. The people that live there can sell their house now and move out into the countryside, which they want to do. You know, what we're talking about really here is how much freedom we want to sacrifice for population growth.
I think I'm correct, and I'm surprised you haven't said it, that there's a big to-do now about illegal immigration and a lot of guilt feeling how to handle it. But the United States takes in legally more immigrants than all the rest of the world put together.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And it's like a million a year. And then that's a lot. And there's been talk in different areas about decreasing that, or at least until we can absorb what we've got. And I don't think that's put on the table enough, that we do take in a lot of illegal immigrants, a lot, every year.
That's most of the growth.
But the places where they live, we are not spending on education. Education brings down the birth rate, and the inner cities are where they live. If we are not living there, then those schools are rotten, and the money is going to the private schools, because we don't want to send our kids to public schools. And so I don't think you can fault the illegal immigrants.
Well, I think it's a state-by-state issue there. I think California does better at it, because the money all goes to the state, and then it all gets redistributed.
I know, but it's, at least where I am, the poorer schools are in the inner city. I think Chicago's the same way. And the only way that the birth rate goes down is if women get educated.
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Mm-hmm. But I'd like to bring up another subject. I don't know how many of you live in a suburban area, but it seems like there's this, you have to have this wonderfully nicely mowed lawn, you have to have this manicured house, you have to have an SUV to carry your children around to all these activities, and it's like you can just spend whatever. Every time you mow your lawn, what is it? It spends as much, or puts out as much pollution as going 20 miles or something. We never talk about the end results of all our consumption. It's all, I'll do whatever I want to.
My lawnmower, zero emissions. Zero energy. Except my energy. I push it.
Yours is
the push mower, yeah.
You got the small one.
But the nice green lawns also do not promote animal life or anything else.
Or infiltration of water.
It's awful.
And they require pesticide and fertilizers to keep them looking nice and green.
Totally, that's what I fertilize my lawn. Or put the weed killer down. It's a nice lawn.
We have wildflowers in our yard. They're called dandelions, but we're getting out of touch with too.
Did anybody here grow up in Sproul? Did you grow up in a place that was sprawling? No, nobody? Nobody wants to admit it?
Yeah.
Did you? Have a guilty look on your face? Because yeah. I wonder about kids who grew up in that environment where their lawns are manicured and they don't have the woodlot or the creek or, you know, even the railroad tracks to go and play at. And you can't go anywhere unless your parents take you. You can't go any further than you can ride on your bike. And you can't really get into good kinds of trouble. You get into sort of bad kinds of trouble. You think of the commercials where kids are smoking pot in their garage because they're bored. They live in the suburbs. Instead of being able to get someplace and do something interesting. Okay, but let's... okay, let me say this. What about sprawl in terms of the loss of neighborliness? Some people talk about that as a problem. You lose your front porch and people move into the backyard.
Yeah, I don't know. That's kind of foremost in my mind when I think about sprawl. But I think by and large, that's kind of what a lot of people want, you know? I think the idea of having a close-knit community where you know all of your neighbors and you have a block party every month or, you know, a barbecue with your neighbors every weekend, I think that's kind of a lost art. I mean, I haven't been on this planet long enough to really say this conclusively, but I just think, generally speaking, like, this country doesn't really have as much of a passion for creating, like, sound communities. You know, I think if you want to talk about, like, the dynamics of a mass society, I mean, not to go upon, like, the age-old cliche, but it kind of reminds me of Germany in the 1930s and 40s, of where the government had this... Sorry, I don't want to get into all this, but basically, you know, there's a huge emphasis on the individual. There was then in Germany, and there is now in this country. You know, we're very proud of that in this country. And I think people want to have that rugged individuality. I think they want to have their own house isolated from everybody else, their own big lawn. And I don't think they really care so much about what the neighbors are doing. You know, unless they have a bigger car, or, you know, conventional lawn.
So it's just competition, not friendliness between your neighbors.
I don't see that at all.
That's kind of the, yeah, I mean, that's the worst case scenario, but yeah.
The pulp and paper company I worked for got purchased by a Japanese company when I was employed there. And the Japanese management that came in to the United States, to Washington State, from Japan, the very first thing they did was buy a big house with a big lot and a high fence, and they were delighted at the opportunity.
Because they're so proud of the Japan. Have you been to Tokyo, or have you been to Japan?
No.
Well, in that tiny houses over there,
yeah.
Tiny lots,
tiny
high prices.
Yeah,
very high.
And very crowded, yeah, very communal.
Yeah, Jan and I were on a trip in China, and one of our guides said the things that every Chinese man wants is a Japanese wife. I won't say anything more about that. A Chinese cook and an American house. So that's what every Chinese person wants. And if you think about, like, some of the other things we've been talking about this week, every Chinese person had their American house, we'd get them into the consumption patterns that we are in as Americans, and we'd be, you know, creating the same, they'd be creating the same sorts of, the same amounts of emissions as we are creating, but how many times is their population greater than ours? Four times greater than ours? So.
1.3 billion, we're about 300 million.
Yeah.
More than four times.
Well, part of it, too, is that people aren't on their front porch, they're not in their backyard. They're not participating in organizations. We try to do something about church other than Sunday morning, and it's like, forget it. They're either watching TV set or the computer screen.
Yeah.
That's
inside
where
the air
an awful lot of time is spent.
Inside the air conditioning,
away from books.
Yeah.
And the houses that they're building, you go down the street and all you see is an unbroken range of garages. You can't even see the front doors, let alone a front porch.
Yeah.
That is changing. They're putting the front porches back on again.
Yeah, well, we're doing some things in Pierce County that I won't try to tell you all about.
I think it really is an intentional thing, though, and it really, I think more people would realize the community aspect is what they wanted if it only takes a couple of people to do it. I moved to Portland about a year ago, and it's more city than it is suburbia where we live. And I live with a 58-year-old woman, and like, she talks to all of her neighbors, like, definitely the talking over the back fence sort of thing. And it surprised me, and just how easy that is to establish. Like, you introduce yourself one day and talk a couple times, and it completely opens up the little neighborhood just by knowing the neighbors. and it's really easy to isolate yourself and to not speak to anybody, but it really only takes a couple times to foster that idea of, yeah, I'm here if you need something, and I'll call if I'm worried about you. And so I think it, if it's something that you are passionate about, I think, or I hope, that it would be contagious once you step up and take the initiative to foster that community.
I agree. I think I found the same things to be true, just talking to neighbors, introducing yourself.
Well, we live on a suburban street, and it's a cul-de-sac in the street at the end. Neighbors are all very friendly. We have all kinds of races there. Some among the friends we get together with a lot are people that are, one family is Japanese descent. And next door we've got this guy, the Egyptian Muslim, next door.
Just moved in.
Down the street's an Hispanic family.
Oh, that's a good neighbor.
That's California.
And yeah. But it's a suburb, yeah, we like it, and it's, people want freedom, and one sign of freedom, which people don't like, that they talk about all the time, is how to get public transportation, but they want their cars. In California, we tried everything. We tried giving incentives to use, we put carpool lanes all over the place, and they still, people most want to drive by themselves in their car in their little cocoon. India and China are both buying cars like you wouldn't believe. They're trying to emulate us. That's what people want.
Right.
So the only answer really is to try and keep the population down so we can give people what they want.
So
instead of having big populations and a lot of rules and a lot of laws, why not work towards a smaller population and more
freedom? Have not talked about anything else all week?
To me, it's a basic problem the world's got.
Well, I just thought that it was kind of interesting because, again, it's, you know, I don't know for sure. I'm Native American, and 50% of Native Americans, proven, don't live on reservations. But there's a new trend where a lot of urban Indians and Natives who didn't grow up on reservations are opting to move back. And if you've ever been on one, 90% of it is not anywhere that I'm sure anyone in here would ever choose to go and live. And yet, we have Natives who have money from casinos. We have Natives who have no money from casinos, like myself, who went to college, got an education that I paid for, and had a good-paying job, and choose to move back to that. And I have to ask why. Because it's not, you know, living in a great suburbia, but would those people, if they won the lottery in California tomorrow, move somewhere better? So really, how tight is that sense of community? And what keeps us together is that sense of family, tribe, who I'm from, where community, that I belong there. These are my people. And that's kind of what Holden has for white people. I mean, no offense, but it's like the Lutheran tribe. I tell people that. And I think it's a tribal concept. And I think he said it over there, the gentleman who worked at a pulp mill, that we will be forced to go back to that. And it almost dawned on me that that would be going back to living when a tribe had to live together. They lived and functioned together because they had to for their very survival, but also their happiness. And it's, again, the value. Why perhaps the reversal of Natives who can't afford to not live in those crappy environments where you're not even allowed to own a home. We don't own our own real estate on a reservation. Why do they choose to do that? And in large part is because of the sprawl, because of the craziness of the regular. I mean, who knows? We don't know why. We just know that this has been a trend within the last 10 years. Mm-hmm. So it's just an observation, because that is like just about as bad as any inner city or immigrant population where they're at is on a reservation. So a lot are opting to move back.
So if you say that people want the independence and the isolation, how does that fit with the fact that we are made to be relational? If we're made in God's image, He is relational, as in the Trinity, and we are made to be in relation with Him and other people. So is that wanting or the desire to be independent, is that a rebellion? Is that something okay? What do you guys think?
Oh, did anybody go to John Marty's eye opener? John Marty. His eye opener this morning?
No.
Where he talked about, and he had a reading from Harper's about how, Americans think that, okay, we're in a Christian country, 85% of Americans say they're Christians, but then they sort of pick and choose what they think of as Christianity, and a lot of that stuff is sort of doesn't fit with what you would think of as like Jesus as the model of a Christian. So I guess that would be my response to that, is even though we would say, yeah, we're a Christian country, well, we don't want to be in these communities and relationships with people. We want to be the rugged individuals, and we'll make that fit into our idea of what a Christian is if we have to. I don't know, that's what I think, but maybe anybody else has an idea on that.
Somewhere we have to strike a balance between identifying with a small group and identifying with a greater whole. Because the identification with the small group limits what can be accomplished to what that group has in terms of functioning capability and resources. And the bigger the group you identify with, the greater is the span of skills, resource, and resources. Okay? But in identifying with the bigger group, it's at the expense of less identity with the smaller group. So where's the optimum point?
Here's a quote that I picked up from the reading that John Marty sent around. Parts of the world where people actually had cut dramatically back on their carbon emissions actually did live voluntarily in smaller homes and take public transit were the same countries where people were giving aid to the poor and making sure everyone had health care. Countries like Norway and Sweden, where religion was relatively unimportant. How could that be? For Christians, there should be something at least a little scary in the notion that, absent the magical answers of religion, people might just get around to solving their problems and strengthening their communities in more straightforward ways. Which I think relates to what you're just saying there. When these people in Norway and Sweden, rather than thinking of themselves as Christians, think of themselves as Norwegians and Swedes to solve their problems.
We're a melting pot, they'll say.
Yeah, we are a melting pot.
But isn't that how New York was? I mean, everybody had their own little place, right? There was the Italians, there was, I don't know, I've never been there.
And there still is.
And there still
is.
If you're Norwegian, you have Norwegian pride. And so we do live in that. I am native, but I am forced to, whether I like it or not. I don't have a choice. I have to live in your world because that's the dominant culture and laws. But I can still retain who I am. And bridge that between both. And if you have that sense of they've found in recovery for people, I don't know how this relates, but it just dawned on me, like alcoholism or whatever, if those people or children that are fostered or adopted out have a connection to their community and feel that one individual within that community they identify with, that their recovery, that's the number one component to their recovery. And I think that we're human. We're not all in this together. We can all love the rainbow, but I'm just saying, we separate one another. That's just a fact based on our looks, our sex, our class. You know, so why not accept that, embrace it, and then just love one another for how God made you? I mean, rather than trying to push it away and pretend like we're all the same, because we're not.
Yeah, and aren't you proud that
you're
Native American?
You should be proud. Right, every person should be proud. We all have to be American. But you can represent, and if you have that pride in who you are, then perhaps like in a big city like New York, where all the different groups coexist together in a small, you know, tight-knit area.
Right, but sometimes they don't coexist very well. Fights and
either in small
sort of gang wars break out between them. Did you have something that you wanted to add? I thought I saw your hand up.
No, you're
good. Okay, we're about 15 minutes to the end. Okay, so is sprawl the source of all our environmental and social ills, or is it a harmless dispersed development pattern, as some people would say? And so when I was putting together this idea for a discussion, I looked up some of the information on how sprawl can be good, or what would be the arguments for sprawl being good. And here are some of them. It generates higher taxes because you have bigger houses and bigger property. And those taxes come from folks who require few social services. They require few public recreation amenities. They require few public safety operations because they tend to be wealthier. So they sort of have their own source and don't need to rely on social services. They have roads that have low traffic volume and so need fewer repairs. And that further expansion of already developed areas can be prohibitively expensive. So if you sprawl out into those open spaces, then you make things more affordable.
Except that sprawl ultimately gets consolidated into urban or suburban areas, at which point it becomes horrendously expensive to go back and retrofit sewer systems and all the things that you neglected the first time around.
Okay.
And they report the roads may not be very congested right where they live, but they can't stay in their own neighborhood. They have to go out and create traffic jams to get to where they have to go for their work, for their Walmart, for whatever it is.
Right, because you don't find those things within your community.
To supply sewage systems that way is prohibitively expensive, and fire protection, police protection, they require. And so I do not agree that they pay taxes at a greater share of what they require of public funding. The only kind of living that, in what I read some time ago, pays more in taxes than they need in public funding is agriculture. And that's what sprawl is doing away with. And if your food comes the 1,300 miles that the average food does come, that's not economical.
Right. And as energy prices increase, food prices will increase because of the transportation costs.
Already have.
Right. And you're getting food that is crappy. Like tomatoes that come from thousands of miles away have to be picked green and then ripened instead of your nice green.
Strawberries that are picked as a blossom and
But are we, if we say, well, let's have policies that discourage sprawl, are we being a kind of eco-fascist, telling people, you must live this way, you can't live the way you want to?
I don't think so, because there have already been policies. Okay. I mean, there are policies all the time, since the country was formed, you know, to like curb behavior, to encourage some behavior, discourage other behavior. So, I mean, unless you think those were all fascist. I mean, I think it was kind of fascist to, like, in Minneapolis, pull up all the rail lines. You know, we had this streetcar system that ran, it was like almost 60 miles, you know, one end to the other. That was all ripped up. You know,
why was that?
Buses. So that could still be running today. You know, so that was a choice.
Why was it taken out, you know?
The buses, not, I mean, General Motors.
General Motors, Firestone.
General Motors took them out.
They bought them or something.
They wanted people to have cars.
Most public transportation is not very well disciplined. You don't have many riders.
But no, I mean, that's not in Minneapolis. I mean, that system was used extensively, you know. And what I'm saying is it was a choice to rip that up. It wasn't an accident.
The rest of these still come back.
You know, with a lot of fighting, and it's more expensive now. You know,
yeah,
so now
rebuild
we're rebuilding and spending money.
As far as I know, there's no public transportation system that pays for itself.
But the highway doesn't pay for itself.
Yeah, that's true.
But
you think that the highway doesn't pay for itself?
Mm-hmm. Well, we pay road taxes, gasoline
taxes.
But it doesn't turn a profit. I mean, the highway doesn't turn a profit. Like, you know, Amtrak or whatever, you know, any kind of public transportation.
Well, we pay gas taxes for roads.
Is that
roads.
Enough to cover the cost of roads, or does the government?
In California, they take gasoline taxes and put them on other things.
Well,
build roads with them. That's why roads are getting kind of crummy in California, because they divert the gas taxes to other purposes, which is against the law, I think.
There seems to be, you made that comment about people building bigger houses and they pay more taxes than they used to. But it also seems like some of the high-end suburbs are becoming, if I can say, more Republican and saying, I don't want to pay those taxes to pay for services for other people. I want to pay my own stuff, and so therefore it's not looking out for the whole society's good.
Yeah.
I don't know if that's helping others.
Does anyone ever really believe that we can legislate against sprawl? I don't know about other places, but in California, the building industry is so powerful that they have the politicians in the palm of their hand, mm-hmm. and they will override anything unless it just gets so bad that we can't live. You know, we can't have any place to grow food anymore.
The state of Washington has passed the Growth Management Act, whereby each county has to designate in the unincorporated areas, urban growth areas, where the intention is that eventually they'll either be annexed or incorporate as other cities. Outside of that, the density is limited. Mm-hmm. Within that, there is a minimum average density required. The urban growth areas cannot be expanded until that minimum average density has been reached, and then they have to be expanded by legislative action. And there are, well, I'm currently serving on 4 different county boards or task forces that are dealing with issues of this sort. Yes, it can be done.
You are making, that's very encouraging. I have not seen that in California.
But they haven't figured out how to make it work in Seattle, where they want to increase urban density. They're trying to get single-family neighborhoods basically to be built up in various kinds of apartments, which is putting a lot of cars on the street, because the average apartment building has one spot per house, and of course you got two people working there. You got the problem that 85% of them are not going downtown, so they can't use the public transportation.
Yeah.
And they haven't figured out how to make it work in the city.
I'm not saying that it's solving all the problems. I'm just saying, yes, it can be legislated and has been.
That's good. That's encouraging. Thank you.
There was an interesting article in the New York Times the other day about the energy situation, and the writer, columnist, pointed out that the very best thing that Congress can do is artificially inflate the cost of gasoline in the short term. And he was recommending like a doubling it. Because if that does not happen, and that's a politically incorrect thing to do, obviously, for most politicians, but if that doesn't happen, external supply-demand situations will bring it on so quickly that we'll have social and economic chaos if we don't force ourselves into dealing with $6 a gallon gasoline on a planned basis. External forces that we have no control over will dump it on us in some unexpected way, and it could cause considerable social and economic upheaval.
What is the point at which, I wonder, what is the point at which people stop driving because gasoline becomes too expensive? I mean, some of us thought it was $3 a gallon, but
it's somewhere around $500 a gallon, I think.
Yeah, I haven't heard what it is. I haven't heard anybody's projection other than, you know, several years ago, people thought it was $3 a gallon.
Right.
And we passed that. And as far as I know, we haven't decreased our usage of it.
I've heard people say, okay, when it gets to be $4, then I'll think about it. Well, that's probably what happened with that $3.
Yeah.
But we do know that there is price elasticity, the term that economists use, in terms of motor fuel. And we saw that price elasticity display itself in 75. Okay. And then people were going to smaller cars and what have you, and controlling their driving a little bit more. 55 mile an hour speed limit was another part of that. And then when the gas prices eased up, what did we do? We raised the speed limit. We got rid of the Volkswagens and the Renaults and went back to moved into the SUVs.
Those things were legislated. They weren't the first choice of a lot of people. Like,
well,
the 55 mile.
The 55 mile thing was legislated.
And the small cars, too.
Yeah.
The gas efficiency.
And some of the small cars.
The CAFE standards.
Yeah.
The forced on industry.
Our zoning laws, because my understanding is a lot of suburbs in the past, zoning laws, you know, so this is commercial, this is residential, you know, use, which is, I think, I see more in the city, you know, wasn't there. So people couldn't live close to work because it was zoned that way. And, like, where I live in Minneapolis, there's a lot of redevelopment in the city of mixed use, you know, of nice condos over businesses. And that's not for everybody. I mean, that, but that works for a large demographic. And that's all about legislation.
Mm-hmm. What about the well-planned sprawl, something like the new urbanist movement to create what has to happen in sprawl in undeveloped lands to create these communities that are compact, that are walkable, that have stores within the communities mm-hmm. within walking distance of your homes and things like that? I know of only maybe a dozen or so, some in Florida, some in outside of Washington, D.C., some in Arizona. But I think the cost to live in those is a little bit higher than your average sprawl. But is that sprawl that you'd be against as well? I mean, are you against all sprawl, or you'll take some that seems more well-planned? And because I think these are communities that are trying to create a community, a sense of belonging, neighborhood areas, but it's still sprawl.
I don't know. I dig the idea. I think it's great that you can provide a community that has, you know, like food and materials that everyone needs and jobs that people go to. They don't have to drive an hour and a half into the city, you know. And I mean, perhaps like the jobs created wouldn't be enough to sustain the community, and they'd still have to go back into the city. I think it's a step forward, you know.
Okay. Anybody else have any last thoughts?
Well, we have provision for master planned communities in this Washington State Growth Management Act. There was one being built east of Tacoma that was built as an employment-based community, which meant it was supposed to provide numerous jobs that people who moved there might be able to do. But then they finally got permission to change it so that the employment-based part was gone. There's a major master planned community still in the planning stages, and they just begun 5-10 years later to start building some homes, and so we don't have any results as to how well that's actually going to work out. Mm-hmm. But that it's for the purpose of doing just what you said.
Okay. Where's that one?
I think one of the problems is that
by morning.
Yeah. These small stores and so on can only charge higher prices because of the lower volume. People are still going to hop in their cars and go to a big box store to buy most of their stuff. Yeah, they'll buy milk and bread there, but you know, but for the big shopping, they'll get in their car and they go someplace.
How many of those big box things do we need? It seems like it's just getting overkill.
I think we need one of each in every community, don't we?
About, what, 10 miles apart or something?
Oh,
is that what it is?
Yeah, I think so. Because you need a Lowe's and a Home Depot, because you need the competition. You need the Target and the Kmart and the Walmart. Right? I mean, you need those things.
Well, actually, there are two things we hate. One is sprawl and the other is density.
That's a good way to end it. Thank you for coming today.
Thank you very much.